So now we have some sharings, various types, and the first one is by Dr. Lori Lippin, who is our presenter for this afternoon's workshop that I hope you will all stay for. And she will introduce herself by way of sharing what she has to tell us this morning. So please come up, Lori, and share with us.
Well, good morning.
Good morning.
You all move right along, don't you? You move so quickly. And I'm struck with what's already happened this morning, and the words joys and sorrows were in my mind, and the joys and sorrows that exist in every community, and the joys and sorrows that we can share when we are a caring community. But there are some sorrows that we don't get to share when there's difference. When there's difference that's unacknowledged or difference that carries bias or prejudice. And so that thought was in my mind as I was coming forward to talk about myself and actually be a kind of predictive talk towards what we'll be doing in the workshop around microaggressions. And the title that you had on your program today, I didn't mean to offend you, and how tough that is when we offend somebody and didn't mean to. When we didn't mean to. It wasn't our intention. And it doesn't make any difference to the person who was offended. Because intention doesn't equal impact. So there are some very subtle things that white people need to learn and that I needed to learn because I never thought of myself as white. So now I'm beginning what I was about to say with that as an introduction, but I also want to thank you. Thank you for having me here today. It's my second UU in 6 months. In January, I was in Florida, in Naples, and attended a marvelous program at the Unitarian Universalist Church there that my friends are members of. And here I am today. I never realized that I would be twice in a Unitarian Universalist company. And so I thank Heidi especially for reaching out to me and a cast of hundreds that made it possible for me to be here. I hope as many of you as can make it will stay for the workshop this afternoon. It's what I do best, is when I do workshops. But speaking I can do too. So a little more about me. I call myself a Jewess. I like the word. I like the way it rolls off my tongue, Jewess. And I'm also reclaiming it because to call someone a Jewess during the times of all those purges in history was an epithet, like preceded by dirty Jewess, right? I'm not just talking about the Holocaust. I'm talking about thousands of years of persecution that my people experienced. So I call myself a Jewess today because I like the word and I do believe reclaiming is important and rewriting a history that we didn't write. So that's important. But also I was born into a Jewish ghetto outside of Boston, a neighborhood outside of Boston. Really, it was all Jewish. My parents were Russian immigrants. I never considered myself Russian. I was only Jewish. Not religious Jewish. Yes, because they were the other generation. We did go to synagogue at the important times, but not on Friday nights. But yes, we had a Friday night. We had Shabbos. We spoke Yiddish in the house. I didn't speak Yiddish. My family wanted to be assimilated like every other immigrant family. My students today talk about that. I teach at UC Davis. I teach a very big diversity class, 120 students, only 15 of whom are white. So it is the most diverse population I could possibly be in, and I love those students. And they also talk about being the translator for their parents, not learning the original language, not learning Tagalog, not learning Chinese, or if they did, how they lost it as they went on. So even my family, I can join them in that immigrant understanding. But in our Jewish ghetto, schools were closed on Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur. The stores down on the main avenue where my father had his pharmacy. It was called Blue Hill Avenue, but they called it Jew Hill Avenue. And there were kosher bakeries, and there were kosher butchers, so I lived in a Jewish bubble, right? And the world for me was made up of Jews and goyim. Now, goyim is also not an epithet. How many know what the word goyim means? Good. You got some Yiddish in you. Actually, it could even be like a Hebrew word, goyim. Some of the Yiddish and the Hebrew is similar. But for me, the understanding of that, goyim literally means the world. That's the actual translation of it. So there was us, the Jews, and there was the rest of the world. So that was my understanding. Did I think of myself as white? No. There was not prejudice overtly that I could recall. My parents never said anything bad about anybody. We did not have a black person working in our home. Matter of fact, we did have someone who worked in my home occasionally, and he was white and Irish. I remember feeling good about that as an adult later on. But there were messages, nevertheless, there were subtleties. I play accordion. I play klezmer accordion, my roots music. And when my mother was taking me to accordion class in downtown Boston, we would drive through Roxbury, Roxbury being the black part of Boston. And my eyes were big, colorful, and there's music going, and all. It looks very different than my neighborhood, so I'm like enchanted. But I'll not forget the nonverbal message that when she reached behind me, and what was she doing? She was locking the doors, you know that. There were subtle messages that something was dangerous there. Maybe I was even attracted to danger, but I've been attracted to difference my whole life. I don't know why, but it's in me. So my Boston upbringing didn't prepare me for what I was going to have happen later on in life. I did go to Brandeis. Some call it a Jewish school, but I considered it a New York school. I learned how to lose my Boston accent in Brandeis. And then on to New York, to social work school. But in New York, in 1965, I heard the parents of Schwerner and Goodman speak. It was the year that they had been found dead in Mississippi, Schwerner, Cheney, and Goodman. And they spoke, because one of those sons was a social work student. And some of us went to Mississippi. So I had my Mississippi summer, my civil rights summer. This ignorant northern white child who doesn't know that she's white yet is going to Mississippi to help. It is so classic. I lived with a black family. I helped start a Head Start school, knowing less about Head Start school than I knew about other things. But fortunately, there were some women from the community that knew a lot more. And I did other things like integrate movie theaters and get involved in things like that, but it was a dangerous time. And I'll only tell you one story from there because it was important for me with the dawning of my ignorance. And I use ignorance quite deliberately. I use it in the classroom too. I use ignorance, not stupidity. I use ignorance because the root of the word means not knowing. We cannot know what we were not taught. We cannot know what we haven't learned is in the fabric of society if nobody pointed it out. We cannot learn, we cannot know it if we're part of the dominant culture and the world is normed based on us. It's normal to us. There is nothing wrong with it. It does not stick out to us because we are the norm. So I found out the kids, five of them in the family, hadn't been to the beach. The beach was just down there in Biloxi. I was in Moss Point, Mississippi. Biloxi. So I said, can we go on the bus? Now, Mr. and Mrs. Gladney never told me I shouldn't go to the beach. You might be thinking in your head something about the beach might not be okay, but I wasn't. There was a beach. I come from Boston. There was a coast. We went to the beach, right? So I took the kids on the bus. She packed us some nice stuff, and we went to the beach. We get off the bus, look across the street. There it is. It's gorgeous. There's a big sandy beach. The ocean is there. We start heading across the street, and what happens? Everybody scatters. There were people on the beach, but they moved away. At first, it didn't register. And I said, oh, because I had integrated movie theaters and some of that with guns pointed at us, but I hadn't thought about this. Ignorant. Had not thought about the fact that the beach was segregated. Well, they moved away. They didn't push us away. They just moved away. So, being a, what did they call us Jewish people in the stereotype? Being one of those, we took the blanket, we sat down. Chutzpah is good. Chutzpah is a good word. Nervy. Chutzpah is nervy. Went and put my blanket down. More space for us. Fine, the kids had a good time. They started getting hungry. There was a Dairy Queen over there. So I said, Clarence, he's the oldest one, Clarence, would you, here, take some money and go over and bring back some hamburgers and stuff or anything like that. So he went off, and within 5 minutes, he was back, but he was walking like this, and I swear he was shuffling his feet with his head down. And he said, they told me they don't serve no, and he used the N-word, which I don't say. They don't serve no, ends there. I said, oh, for God's sakes, that's absurd, that's terrible. This is a public place, we can go. So I, again, ignorant, take the kids' hands, we go across the street, we go to the Dairy Queen, I face the woman right there, young woman. She looks at me, pulls down the screen with a loud bang, and we don't serve no white trash neither. I'm beginning to get it. It's not very subtle, I'm beginning to get it. I know I can't walk in the white part of town, they don't want to have anything to do with me, but now I'm beginning to get it. I'm getting how the kids are sitting there while we're watching TV and they're running their hands up my arm because they haven't seen hair like that on an arm. And I'm watching the TV and I'm seeing that Superman and everybody else they're watching have white faces. But I'm watching it from within their black world. I'm beginning to see something that I never saw before. So in fact, Mississippi was an extraordinary experience for me. I was living in New York at the time. But when I came back to New York and went to my favorite Chinese restaurant in Harlem, and I'm feeling like, oh, I'm back in Mississippi. I wasn't in Mississippi. I was in Harlem. These people didn't know me. I was a fly in the buttermilk. I was the opposite of a fly in the buttermilk. I was a buttermilk. And there I was. So I had something to learn. My next instrumental piece that started me on the path of how I managed to unravel whiteness and then write a book about it, which I didn't bring up, but it's in the briefcase back there if you want to just pick up a copy. So I moved to California. My story takes a lot more than 10 minutes, but I'm giving you the highlights. Moved to California to participate in the consciousness that you all have here that I did not think happened on the East Coast. I was tired of Boston, New York, Maryland is where I went, got a PhD, and I said, I've had enough of the East Coast. I'm going west. It was my midlife adventure. I wanted to live under a different influence, a different geography, a different consciousness. And in fact, I found it. I have also found that the East Coast is doing its own thing to bring itself up in the world, and there's nothing necessarily magical here. But I came out to California, and a very important summer experience with women in a solstice camp we had created that happened every summer for a week, in which we went, women of color and white women, to do our spirituality work, to do goddess work. Some of it did religious work. It was a whole mixture of everything. But that year, the camp exploded in cries of classism, if not racism. We were throwing money toward the creation of a book by Maria Gumbadas, whose co-author was there writing a book on the goddess. It sounded wonderful to us. And money was flowing from these white women to get this. And the black women, they got so angry. They said, Do you realize what is happening here in this camp environment? Most of us are on scholarship. Most of us are in the kitchen. You have all this money. Do you have any idea of the distance between us? And a big hullabaloo and separation and conflict and the beginning of some diversity work together. But at that point, when we finally got back together again, because they separated out from us for a full day, and drummed and cried and wailed their pain at how their sisters, who they thought were sisters with them, didn't really get it. And when they came back together, very graciously, very generously, I might say, they came back drumming and dancing and formed a circle and invited us into their circle. They had done what they needed to do to get themselves together. But just before that happened, I was sitting with the rest of the white women. We were so nervous. And one of my friends, black woman, Oakland, probably from Oakland, She pointed her finger, and I could have sworn she was pointing it directly at me. I'm picking you. And she said, you white women got to do your own work. We are tired of educating you. And that was the truth. They had been educating us. And I had many friends across the color line. I had lovers, partners across the color line. I still stepped in it from time to time. I never meant to. I was getting my education from them. So it was a result of that that I decided to start a white women's group. I still lived in Oakland, but women came to that group from Oakland in Sonoma County. And for 7 years, we met in a white women's group, which was a funny name because when you tell people, they think we were white supremacists, you know? We were a white women's group trying to find out what that meant. And I was doing diversity trainings, but it was still a problem for me. It was still a problem for me. So I started, after that, 7 years of that. Can I still do my poem?
Yes, absolutely.
Extrovert. I'm an extrovert. Big extrovert. Extroverted intuitive, even. So it was a result of the 7 years with those women where we struggled with ourselves and each other and went places and did diversity things to begin to get ourselves educated. And it was a result of that seven-year group that I put together what was then a model for working with other white women that became the book, Unraveling Whiteness, which is what I use in my course now. And we were doing pieces that are part of that in this afternoon's workshop. And it's been a very successful book to use in the college environment where my 15 white students very bravely, very courageously are finding out about how they carry white privilege in the world, witnessed by the students of color who are so generous and caring and happy that their fellow students are doing this. They support them 100%. And of course, we're also hearing their stories of racial profiling and all the other microaggressions that every day in their lives, every day in their lives. So in that spirit, I brought a poem to read, that is read in the class. At the beginning of my class, three students volunteer every week to read a poem. They don't deconstruct it, they just read it, let that voice ring out, and then just tell us why they picked it. This is one of the first ones. For the White Person Who Wants to Know How to Be My Friend by Pat Parker. She wrote it in an introductory paragraph in order to help us to learn to live more multiculturally. Because we do not know how to live multiculturally. I agree with her on that. We live in self-segregated societies. We hunger for it, but something is in the way. I think it has a lot to do with us. So Pat Parker writes, "The first thing you do is to forget that I'm black. Second, you must never forget that I'm black." Good, you got it. "You should be able to dig Aretha, but don't play her every time I come over." "And if you decide to play Beethoven, don't tell me his life story. They made me take music appreciation too. Eat soul food if you like it, but don't expect me to locate your restaurants or cook it for you. And if some black person insults you, mugs you, rapes your sister, rapes you, rips off your house, or is just being an ass, please do not apologize to me for wanting to do them bodily harm. It makes me wonder if you're foolish. And if you really believe blacks are better lovers than whites, don't tell me. I start thinking of charging stud fees. In other words, if you really want to be my friend, don't make a labor of it. I'm lazy, remember?" So Pat Parker has a sting. She's got an adage. She has a sting. There's a lot in there. This is the last thing I'm going to read. My students write reactions papers about what they're reading. And this student wrote this quarter, and I wanted to bring it into you. I was grading it when I knew I was coming here, and I had to bring it just to expand on this. This is from Margaret. She writes, "After reading For the White Person Who Wants to Be My Friend, a short poem by Pat Parker, inside the class reader, I felt that the author was trying to relay this message. that people make honorable attempts to act unprejudiced, but often approach them the wrong way. No one, including myself, wants anyone else to sympathize for us for being of a certain ethnicity, because that's assuming that either being of this ethnicity is not ideal, which is racist, or that we don't like being who we are. My favorite lines in her poem are the first two. The first thing you do is forget that I'm black. Second, you must never forget that I'm black, to which a lot of you laughed. Because even though at first it may sound as if she's contradicting herself, her message is extremely clear, which I believe you got. If I had written those lines by simply exchanging the word Asian for black, I would hope that others would interpret it as, first, I want you to forget about all the stereotypes that are associated with my ethnicity. Don't make prejudgments about me based on my ethnicity, because that would be equivalent to me looking at myself in a cracked mirror. It would present an inaccurate reflection and representation of myself. However, don't be ignorant of my ethnicity, because it's a part of who I am. To me, these first two lines are the first steps in removing the stereotypes that have been forever manifested in everyone's attitudes. And if ever we want to live in an unprejudiced society, we have to stop making first impressions of others. I think to be unprejudiced means not to propose any prejudgments of others, thus not assuming anything about them based on their race or ethnicity, even if the assumption could be considered a positive attribute. You hear what she's asking for. It's almost impossible not to have in our mind what's been planted in our mind. But I can say what is possible is to not act on it. Thank you very much.
I didn't realize we were going to have a song that would make me cry right before I talked. Here's a little thought experiment. Suppose we white people decided that henceforth the word whites would mean everybody, people of all colors. Of course, sometimes it would still mean just white people too, but try that out. I hope this seems as preposterous to you as it does to me. Here's another idea. Suppose we say that when we say man or men, we mean all people. Is that any different? If anyone thinks it is, I invite you to buttonhole me afterwards and explain it to me. One of the problems with this kind of language, of course, is that it's easy to think that you're picturing the whole human race when you're actually just picturing men. When I was 10 or 12, I read in a book that the basic needs of man were clothing, food, shelter, and access to females. Females of what species, you wonder? It reminded me of a science fiction book I once read that had aliens in it where the female of the species was non-sentient. So, you know, there's man, the human being, and then there are females. Every time I hear the words man or men used in this supposedly generic way, I feel excluded, dismissed, devalued. It's a pretty safe bet that my experience, sometimes my very existence, is going to be discounted or ignored. This language didn't work for me when I was 10, and 50 years later, it still turns me off. In contrast, if the language specifically includes me, I feel happy and empowered. The first time I read a book that didn't use exclusively male pronouns, I nearly cried. So if you want to communicate with me, engage me, focus my attention in a positive way on the content of your message rather than in a negative way on the form of your message. You'll be more successful if you use language that deliberately includes me rather than language that unconsciously shuts me out. Thank you.
Knows me well, knows that I see the world through a humorous lens. But humor is a funny thing. The saying, laughter is the best medicine, is really literally true. It's laughter is the best medicine for healing, for loving, for learning. Laughter is the best way to heal. However, I've also found that laughter can be the sharpest sword as well. The difference is when people are laughing at me versus with me. I found in my life that people who are making a joke to my face about something about me tend to think that as my friend, their relationship with me somehow makes it okay for them to joke about something that they don't experience. Have you heard people who feel that they can tell a slightly racist joke because they have friends who are black or Asian or Jewish or whoever is the butt of that joke? Now, I think people often make jokes when they're uncomfortable. When they do that, I think they're avoiding owning their discomfort and trying to get the people around them to laugh with them, and importantly, to side with them about who or whatever it is that's making them uncomfortable. This is something that my husband calls othering, which is excluding someone who's different from you or erecting a barrier between you and them to deal with that discomfort. It's othering. As a bisexual woman, I have felt the edge of that humor sword more times than I like to remember. For example, I belonged to a group that was LGBT people and allies when I worked at Procter & Gamble. After many years in the group, I started a relationship with a man after having been in relationships only with women for probably the previous 20 years. And everybody in the group was making jokes about what they imagined we did in bed together, because that's, you know, it's kind of the reverse of, gee, it seems funny to do breeder sex versus, you know, same-sex sex. Anyway, there were all these jokes about that. Now, it's an LGBT group, but the message was clear that the B is supposed to be in same-sex relationships or just shut up about it. And the message I picked up was I couldn't be all of who I was, which was maybe I would be with a woman, maybe I would be with a man, maybe I would be with someone who identified as genderqueer, but I couldn't be that whole me. Their laughter about that topic, though, really belittled me, and it hurt me. And more so because I knew that if I did anything other than laugh along with them, that I would be seen as overly sensitive, right? After all, it was just a joke. So, and that's the deadly part about making jokes about someone who, about who someone else is or what they do. It robs that person of self-defense. Because what it does is it makes them complicit in that othering that you're doing to them with your joke. And it does that because if they resist, then it actually deepens their exclusion. So best of all, though, for the joker, they actually have plausible deniability because, after all, it really was just a joke.
What today is really about is about, for us Unitarian Universalists, it's about living our faith It's about especially living our cherished first principle, which calls upon all of us to affirm, to defend, and to promote the worth and dignity of every person. That is what today is about, and that is what, in part, our lives are about as Unitarian Universalists. The worth and dignity of every person. There are no exceptions. I'd like to offer you a prayer. Spirit of life, Spirit of love, help us to renew our resolve to heal our broken world. A world broken by centuries of hatred and prejudice, by persistent racism, sexism, heterosexism, and ethnic hatreds. A world broken by continuing acts of violence against those who have long been oppressed. A world broken by our own unconscious biases, when the words we use or the things we do thoughtlessly cause pain and feelings of exclusion. Be with us in these challenging times as people are denied their rights, their dignity, and even their lives. Be with all of those who feel the sting of bias and the pain of injustice. Help us to stand with and for the oppressed, to stand firm against oppression in its many forms. Help us to understand how the oppression and exclusion of whole groups of people is aided by our own thoughtless words or acts, or by our silence when we witness the prejudiced behavior of others. Gracious Spirit of life, help us to heal ourselves so that we can work together to heal the world. Amen. Blessed be.
I think we can all share the fact that between the mails and the unsolicited phone calls and emails, we are always being asked to demonstrate our generosity, all for good causes. But unless you are a bottomless pit, it's necessary to prioritize. If this church is one of your priorities, we ask your support. The ushers will now pass the offertory baskets, but if you are a visitor, we ask that you let the baskets pass you by. You are our guests.
Thank you.
Now, if you turn to hymn number 1023 in the teal hymnal, Building Bridges, please stand as willing and able.
And I think we're going to try to sing this as a round, but it has four parts, but let's just do two. There aren't four easy divisions here. Let's sing it through once in unison, and then we'll go into two parts, part one right here, part two here.
Building bridges between our divisions, I reach out to you, will you reach out to me? With all of our voices and all of our visions, friends, we could make such sweet harmony. Building bridges between our divisions, reach out to you, will you reach out to me? With all of our voices and all of our visions, friends, we can make such sweet harmony.
Once more.
Building bridges between our divisions, I reach out to you, will you reach out to me? With all of our voices and all of our visions, friends, we could make such sweet harmony.
I invite you to connect with those around you for our closing words. And these words are the words of Gene Roddenberry. Bringing him in at the end of this service just seemed so appropriate because he had a vision when he created Star Trek. And it's a vision we have yet to realize. He projected Star Trek into the 23rd century. That's where it takes place. At least the first incarnation of Star Trek. There have been many, as you know. And this is what he wrote. Intolerance in the 23rd century? Improbable. If humans survive that long, they will have learned to take delight in the essential differences between people and between cultures. We will learn that differences in ideas and attitudes are a delight, part of life's exciting variety, not something to fear. It's a manifestation of the greatness that God, or whatever it is, gave us. This infinite variation and delight, this is part of the optimism we built into Star Trek. Let us carry on his vision and build it into the world we live in and the world that is to come. May you go in peace. And please, if you can help us set up, we're going to set up in the front here in a U with the tables. Please do partake of our wonderful lunch. There's plenty of food. And come back for the workshop.